Samaritans are lending a helping hand to the needy, even as fear and anxiety loom large. Said Ali Safid, Indian administered Kashmir.
In the limelight.
Were the media concerned with speaking truth to power? The case of Sheikh Jarrah perfectly exposes the magnitude of Israeli regime hypocrisy and deceit, says Blaine Fernandez, author, in an article titled Western Media Continues to Report Israeli Regime's Blatant Brutality as Clashes and Scuffles. Stay tuned for more. Let's imagine some creative wartime reporting. On April 26, 1937, the inhabitants of the Basque town of Guernica clashed with German warplanes, dropping high explosives and incendiary bombs. The town was pulverized in the course of the scuffle, and up to 1,600 people perished. Obviously, these lines would never be written by any non-delusional person, since the nature of power relationship between human bodies, on the one hand, and bomb-spewing airborne monstrosities, on the other hand, is quite clear. Yet, when it comes to the Israeli regime-Palestinian conflict itself, a euphemism for Israeli regime's forever war on Palestinians, the Western corporate media never miss a chance to report blatantly one-sided brutality as clashes and scuffles. Take, for example, the Great March of Return, the overwhelmingly peaceful demonstrations that began in the Gaza Strip in March 2018. According to the United Nations, the Zionist regime military killed 214 Palestinians, 46 of them children, in the context of the Great March, and injured more than 36,100. During the same period, by contrast, one Israeli troop was killed and seven others were injured. The media take away from the same event: there were clashes. Now, the Zionist regime's ethnic cleansing operations in occupied East Al-Quds have provided news outlets with another opportunity to exercise their preferred vocabulary, insofar as they can be bothered to report on the events at all. 40 Palestinians, including 10 children, currently face eviction from their homes in East Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to make way for more incoming right-wing settlers. The latest round in a decades-long Zionist regime campaign of forced re-displacement of Palestinian refugee families from 1948. As if the injustice were not already epic enough, Israeli regime police have responded to protesters in Sheikh Jarrah by, inter alia, charging them on horseback and dousing the area with tear gas and skunk water, a delightful Israeli invention. On top of that, the Zionist regime security forces have assaulted Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque, firing rubber-coated metal bullets and stun grenades and injuring hundreds. But for the media, it's all in a day's scuffle. There were scuffles and clashes galore in the Washington Post, on the ABC News website, in the Guardian, at Fox News, and again at the Post. The BBC, for its part, has dutifully kept its audience updated about clashes and confrontations, while insisting that, in firing stun grenades and the like, the Zionist regime police have simply been acting in response to Palestinian provocations, just as The Israeli regime is always acting in response when it, like, slaughters thousands of people in Gaza. From the get-go, the success of the Zionist regime enterprise was predicted on a policy of ethnic cleansing, the same policy now playing out in Sheikh Jarrah. But it is not the function of the New York Times and like-minded publications to connect the historical dots and thereby provide a contextualized picture of systematic Israeli dispossession of Palestinians, as opposed to localized confrontations. Furthermore, by quoting patently ludicrous Israeli foreign ministry statements without making it clear that they are patently ludicrous, the Times is merely assisting in the propagation of the Zionist regime narrative and the normalization of occupation. Imagine for a moment that, say, the Foreign Ministry of Guatemala issued a statement claiming that coronavirus was transmitted by unicorns. Then imagine finding this statement reprinted in the U.S. newspaper of record without some sort of indication that the suggestion was, you know, nuts, and you get an idea of what the Palestinians are up against in terms of global media coverage. Were the media actually concerned with rigorousness and speaking truth to power? The case of Sheikh Jarrah perfectly exposes the magnitude of the Zionist regime hypocrisy and deceit. It's a damn fine point, indeed, if one considers the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians expelled from their properties by the fake regime of Israel in 1948 and the millions of Palestinian refugees currently denied their right of return. In other words, there is loads of stuff to be reported beyond the clash and scuffle business if only the truth were marketable. Then, of course, there are the media interventions that make Western mainstream coverage look relatively sane in comparison, like the recent one in the Israel Hayom newspaper by Caroline Biglick, who takes us above and beyond clashes and scuffles to a powder keg, courtesy of Washington. The prize for number one criminal offense thus goes not to the Israeli regime's ethnic cleansing, rubber bullet barrages, or police-induced suffocation, but rather to, you guessed it, subtitles. And as a direct line between U.S. and Israeli regime epicenters of oppression shows no sign of slackening, a media that didn't toe that line would certainly be helpful.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Proper Nutrition with Brother Sayyid Vahid Alavi in the program The Month of Allah.
Assalamu alaikum everyone, this is Sayyid Wahid and welcome to another program of the month of Allah. We talked about health issues and I will continue with the same topic inshallah ta'ala in this part of the program. Stomach pain or heartburn or stomach inflammation are some of the health issues that we have during Ramadan. And the reason is that an increased acid level in the empty stomach during Ramadan leads to inflammation of the stomach, which appears as a burning sensation in the stomach and under the ribs and can spread to other places also. Try to avoid spicy foods and coffee, and these two make the condition worse. So try to avoid those things. There are medical treatments for controlling your stomach inflammation and the level of gastric acid in the stomach, and the patient should consult their physician. And we have also kidney stones. Kidney stones may be created in people who drink less water. Therefore, the high consumption of liquids is necessary to prevent kidney stones. Joints pain. Some people may have pain in their joints, and the causes for that may be is that during the holy month of Ramadan, it is strongly recommended to pray a lot. Recommended prayers are there according to the narrations, and you have a lot of physical pressure on your knees and joints, especially for the elderly and the people with the joint inflammation. This causes pain, stiffness, swelling, and discomfort. The treatment for that is lower the weight of your body before Ramadan. Physical activity is very important, and I say it with full love and respect to all of you. Physical activity is something that I strongly recommend during Ramadan, before Ramadan, and after Ramadan. Does not matter. For your own health. So exercise your joints to prepare yourself for Ramadan. Physical readiness gives you a better health during Ramadan. We mentioned the health problems, the symptoms, the causes, and the treatments in these couple of programs. In the coming programs of the holy month of Allah, we'll talk more about food items that we should try to avoid. Until then, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you. Ramadan Kareem.
صفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان
The people of Palestine have long suffered aggression at the hands of Israel, but that escalated to epic proportions in this Ramadan. The regime launched a crackdown on Palestinian worshippers and restricted their gatherings in the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds during the Muslim holy month. Later in the month, an Israeli court ruled that over a dozen Palestinian families must leave their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem al-Quds immediately, despite having lived there for generations. The eviction order sparked several protests in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The crackdown on ensued injured hundreds of Palestinians. It also drew condemnations from the international community against Israel, with even the Arab countries that have recently normalized ties with the regime, namely Sudan, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, denouncing the Israeli forces' storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
It's not only the general oppression of Israel, but Israel got very aggressive with the district of Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah, where they want to get rid of all the remaining Palestinian families. The Israelis, I think, did not anticipate what they were stepping into when they chose to evict all of these families at the same time in the month of Ramadan.
The United Nations Human Rights Office urged Israel to cease the eviction order immediately. It said, "The transfer of parts of an occupying power's civilian population into the territory that it occupies is prohibited under international humanitarian law and may amount to a war crime." Israel has been trying to downplay the recent clashes, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu strongly rejecting international pressure not to build settlements in Jerusalem al-Quds.
We also firmly reject the pressures not to build in Jerusalem. To my regret, these pressures have been increasing of late. I say also to the best of our friends, Jerusalem is Israel's capital, and just as every nation builds in its capital and builds up its capital, we also have the right to build in Jerusalem and to build up Jerusalem. That is what we have done, and that is what we will continue to do.
But under international law, all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal. The United Nations Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement-building activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Jerusalem al-Quds remains at heart of a decades-long conflict, with Palestinians insisting that East al-Quds, illegally occupied by Israel since 1967, must serve as the capital of a Palestinian state. In the meantime, the Al-Aqsa Mosque has had enormous significance throughout the years. In the year 2000, an Israeli official's visit to the holy site provoked a Palestinian uprising known as the Second Intifada. Observers say the recent escalation of violence surrounding the Al-Aqsa Mosque could be a prelude to a third intifada.
As far as I'm concerned, an intifada is always possible in Palestine. The Israelis are putting more and more pressure. They're hoping to keep the pressure at just the right level to cause, to motivate the ethnic cleansing, the expulsion of the Palestinians, the marginalization of the Palestinians, without having it explode completely.
Emboldened by former U.S. President Donald Trump's all-out support, Israel has stepped up its aggression against the Palestinian people. But with Trump gone, for how long can it keep on committing its crimes?
The coronavirus pandemic has struck a heavy blow against major economies across the globe. Many people have lost their jobs or seen their income cut. However, development of vaccines was a breakthrough. Countries across the globe launched vaccination programs in order to reverse this negative trend and help their economies recover. Yet things have not worked out well for the world's largest economy, the U.S. According to the latest monthly employment report by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. economy gained only 266,000 jobs last month. That is while economists had expected the number to top 1 million. Also, the unemployment rate rose to 6.1% amid an increasing shortage of available workers. But there were more bad news, as March's originally estimated 916,000 job gains were revised down to 770,000. Vaccination efforts and the relaxing of lockdown measures across the U.S. were expected to result in steady job growth. Yet the disappointing report is a surprise setback for U.S. President Joe Biden's efforts to revive America's economy from the coronavirus pandemic conundrum.
We came to office, we knew we were facing a once-in-a-century pandemic and a once-in-a-generation economic crisis. And we knew this wouldn't be a sprint, it'd be a marathon.
The April data shows the U.S. economy still has 8.2 million fewer jobs than it had in February of 2020, before the pandemic hit.
We're still digging out of an economic collapse that cost us 22 million jobs. Let me say that again. It cost us 22 million jobs. When we came in, we inherited a year of profound economic crisis and mismanagement on the virus.
Biden claims his $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package is helping the U.S. economy to recover and is also pushing for another $4 trillion to be spent on infrastructure, education, and other priorities. However, his critics object to the high price tag and are warning that that could bring inflation. Moreover, Republicans and business groups have raised concerns about a disincentive for people to return to their jobs.
The reality was 75% less than what they had predicted. So it's a huge shortfall. I believe the economy is much weaker. I believe all the talk about a super powerful recovery was overdone. I think the economy is really struggling with the after effects of the pandemic. It's listless. It's weak. There are huge financial problems.
The U.S. Labor Department's monthly report fell significantly short of expectations. While economists predicted that the economy would add about 1 million jobs, the report was a huge disappointment. Economists attribute the disappointing results to a range of issues, including safety concerns, child care issues, as well as extended unemployment benefits. In addition, according to government surveys, the number of unemployed workers is way higher than job openings. Also, there have not been any meaningful wage increases either, which are a hallmark of labor shortage.
There's a lot of speculation as to why. The Republicans, the conservatives blame it on over-generous unemployment benefits. I'm very skeptical. I think those jobs do not pay very well. I think if wages were higher, workers would be quicker to sign on. But as things stand now, the wages are so low that it may be more worth their while to stay at home and take care of the kids.
Unemployment rates for black and Latino women remained high. That is while women are being employed at lower rates in the U.S. Meanwhile, the hard-hit hospitality sector, which includes restaurants and hotels, and also manufacturing sectors, are unable to fill the job openings. That is while the unemployment rate is at high levels. Many unemployed Americans are reluctant to look for jobs because they fear catching the coronavirus. Others have entered new occupations and have left their old jobs. Moreover, many women, working mothers in particular, have left the workforce to care for children. Republicans and critics blame the Biden administration's policies for the slow economic recovery.
Well, that's what the Republicans complain. They want to see unemployment benefits cut because they want to force workers to go back to work. But it's very hard to tell. The wages have fallen very low, and workers have a lot of responsibilities at home.
The latest report reveals that the U.S. economy still has a long way to go to recover from the coronavirus pandemic.
The remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal have been meeting in the Austrian capital, Vienna, in recent weeks to find a way to salvage the international accord. While few details about the talks have been revealed, Press TV has learned that the U.S. and the European signatories to the deal apparently want the destruction of Iran's new generation centrifuges in return for a temporary suspension of some of the sanctions related to the nuclear deal, officially titled the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. This is while, under the JCPOA, Iran's advanced centrifuges, including IR-4, IR-6, and IR-9s, must be stored away under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency and not destroyed. Press TV obtained information that shows Iran won't give in to the excessive demands of the Westerners, and also in case of insistence on the part of the other side, the possibility of the JCPOA, and not just the negotiations in Vienna, unraveling altogether will be real.
The Iranians have seen what the Americans and the Europeans have done. They've talked and talked and talked a lot about how they want the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action to succeed, and yet they've done everything in their power to ensure that it won't succeed. The Europeans refuse to permit to trade with Iran in any kind of barter arrangement, even with that INSTEX, that International Exchange Program. So they're simply kowtowing to the Americans, acting as their running dogs, and simply making a big production out of nothing. It's a simple matter to abolish the sanctions and rejoin the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But of course they won't do that, and they want to blame the Iranians for their own failures.
The new demands, meant to impose new nuclear commitments on Iran, have been put forward while the U.S. has not even agreed to remove all the JCPOA-related sanctions, a condition set by Tehran for a possible U.S. return to the nuclear deal. U.S. President Joe Biden has expressed his willingness to reverse Trump's policy regarding the JCPOA and to rejoin the deal. However, his administration has so far refused to take any meaningful action to gain Iran's trust and come back to compliance. External influences may have been a contributing factor. The U.S. president has reportedly met with the head of the Israeli regime's intelligence service, Mossad, in Washington, D.C. last week and told him his country isn't close to returning to the Iran nuclear deal. Biden reportedly said the United States has a long way to go in talks with Iran before it agrees to return to full compliance, comments that appear to have been assurances to Israel, which is a vehement opponent of the deal. The Mossad chief also reportedly asked Biden not to rejoin the accord without improving it first.
Well, Yossi Cohen, meeting with Jack Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor in Washington, with Biden just happening, mind you, happening to drop by the talks, is a clear indication that it's outside pressure and it's aimed at making inside demands and inside controls on the American government by the Israelis to reject and ditch the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The Israelis are probably afraid that someone might ask questions about why the JCPOA applies only to Iran and why isn't there not one that applies to Israel, India, and Pakistan, other nuclear states, with a very unstable track record. So I think that it is pressure from the inside, pressure under the table, if not subterranean.
Iran says the ball is in the U.S.'s court to return to the agreement and remove all its sanctions on Tehran, or pursue the failed policy of its predecessor, known as Maximum Pressure Campaign, and push ahead with its hostile policy against the Islamic Republic.
Israel's occupation of Palestine and the plight of Palestinians have once again come into focus globally as people worldwide mark the International Quds Day. Every year, on the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan, pro-Palestinian groups from all faiths show solidarity with those affected by the occupation. The issue of Palestine is today recognized as one of the most complicated crises that seems far from any kind of resolution. But when did it all begin? The mass displacement of Palestinians from their ancestral lands mainly dates back to May 14, 1948, when Israel was created in Palestine and immediately recognized by the United States. Palestine had been under British colonial control until May that year. Britain had long encouraged Zionist Jews to come to Palestine. The 1948 Declaration of Independence is widely considered as the starting point for an occupation that has triggered many wars and impacted the whole Middle East and the world. Soon after the creation of Israel, the forced displacement of Palestinians, known as the Nakba, or catastrophe, began. Several hundred Palestinian villages were razed to the ground, and their residents were forced to flee and were never allowed to return. Today, the refugees and their descendants around the world number 5 million. Israel has been seizing more Palestinian lands over the past decades and keeps building on them. What's now left for the Palestinians is a tiny fraction of their original homeland. This map shows how Palestinian territories have been shrinking over the past decades. The Israeli violations of Palestinians' rights are many. To Israeli authorities, Palestinian lives don't matter at all. The Israeli regime does not hesitate to kill. Meanwhile, the regime has engaged in demographic engineering, discrimination in access to education, healthcare, and building rights. Just days ago, leading international rights group Human Rights Watch issued a report condemning Israel for committing the crimes of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories. In 2017, the UN Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia issued a damning report on Israeli practices in occupied Palestinian territories. The report said Israel has established an apartheid regime that oppresses the Palestinians as a whole. But for Israel, such reports and repeated UN resolutions are no big concern, as the regime has full U.S. diplomatic cover. Meanwhile, Palestinians have been let down by some Arab states. Last year, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan recognized Israel and normalized their ties with the regime. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinians know all too well that their options are very limited at the moment. As many governments refuse to pressure the Israeli regime, it is hoped that resistance and popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day change things for the better.
Raising awareness, circulating these things on social media, holding your politicians accountable, also bring the campaign aid. I mean, help people in Palestine. You know, everybody can reach out to somebody in Palestine and let them videotape the scenario around them. Like, you know, Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, we always have campaign aids in Gaza. And, you know, when they get us video coverage of the houses inside and how they're living in their neighborhoods, this already by itself shows how this blockade and this occupation has treated these people and what status they're at right now. They're living in poverty. They're living in the worst conditions. And this is because of the occupation, nothing else.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. Please stay tuned. Imam al-Sadiq states, a believer must know about the content of the Holy Quran, whether he is alive or at the time of death. Even if a person is illiterate or old, he can listen to its recitation and gradually he can memorize the Holy Quran. If you decide to memorize only one verse every night, after 1 year, you have more than 300 verses in your mind. Now, one of the occasions in which people are inattentive towards the Holy Quran is when they do not try to recite Quran properly. This is more important for university students, school boys and girls, and even the teachers. It is very unfortunate to see that some of the graduates and postgraduates recite the Holy Quran in a wrong manner. This is a type of weakness. However, it can be solved by practice. Just look at the great man of Allah and how much attention they had towards the Quran. Imam Ar-Rawla used to recite the whole Quran in 3 days. The late Imam Khomeini also did this. Of course, the recitation of the Quran must be with contemplation, and if it is difficult for you to read the whole Quran, at least try to recite short surahs and ayahs of it. In a narration, we read that if a person read out 50 ayahs of the Quran, he or she will not be considered among the neglectful or inattentive ones. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Subhanallah, walhamdulillah, la ilaha illallah, wallahu akbar, la ilaha illallah.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah. Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the Month of Allah. In this segment, we'll be talking about famous reciters of the Quran in the world of Islam. Today, we're going to be talking about Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar. Iranians very much like this reciter, especially those who are fans of Quran recitation. He first visited Iran in the 1990s, and he was warmly received by all Iranians. This great reciter was born in 1950 in the Qahliya Governorate of Egypt. He memorized the Quran at an early age, and then learned the rules of tajweed and other sciences pertaining to the recitation of the Quran. There were other reciters in this region who Sheikh Shahat Anwar was very much influenced by them, especially Sheikh Abdul Samad Az-Zanati. This reciter influenced Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar the most. And of course, another reciter was Sheikh Hamdi Zamil. Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar quickly became a very talented reciter. He had a very beautiful voice, a very good voice, and he became famous all over Egypt and all over the world. He visited Iran several times. The first time that he visited Iran, he recited the Quran in different cities of Iran. One of his best recitations was in Mashhad, the place where Sheikh Shahat Anwar had called the center of Quran recitation in the world after Egypt. He recited Suratul Ma'idah, verses 114 to 115. In Mashhad. Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar has three sons. His first son and his third son, his eldest son and his third son, who are Sheikh Anwar Shahat and Sheikh Mahmud Shahat, respectively, are both very good reciters of the Quran. And they visit Iran occasionally to recite the Quran. Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar had told his sons, these two sons of his, that when you go to Iran, make sure that you recite the Quran well. Make sure that you care about Iran. And that is what we see when we look at the recitations of Sheikh Anwar Shahat and Sheikh Mahmud Shahat, we see that they recite the Quran very well when they come to Iran. Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar, in his late 40s or early 40s, he contracted a disease which was, he couldn't recite the Quran anymore. It was a disease of the larynx. and he couldn't recite the Quran anymore. And in the year 2008, at the age of 58, Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar passed away. May Allah bless this reciter and elevate his ranks. With this introduction, let's listen to Surah Al-Ma'idah, verses 114 to 115 by Sheikh Shahat Anwar, which was performed in Mashhad. Let's enjoy this recitation.
Said Jesus, the Son of Mary, O Allah, our Lord, send down to us a table spread with food from the heaven, to be for us a festival for the first of us and the last of us, and a sign from you. And provide for us, and you are the best of providers. Allah said, Indeed, I will send it down to you. But whoever disbelieves afterwards from among you, then indeed will I punish him with a punishment by which I have not punished anyone among the worlds.
does have ties to Muslim extremists. I don't know.
In mid-March, the Yemen Ansarullah movement published a number of secret documents and phone calls belonging to former Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Among them, two calls between Saleh and then-director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, George Tenet, dating back to 2001. In these calls, Tenet is pressuring the Yemeni president to release a man involved in the bombing attacks on USS Cole in October of the year 2000, which left 17 dead and 37 injured. The shocking point is that the man is a senior member of Al-Qaeda. That's while the United States has started bloody wars in the Middle East under the pretext of fighting the very same terrorist group.
This is the most difficult decision I've ever had.
Him illa an-nar, wa la yukallimuhum Allah.
In one of the phone calls, Tenet is asked by Saleh's translator about the name of the individual in question. He says he doesn't want to give his name over the phone. Saleh asks Tenet if the FBI personnel could meet with him to discuss the matter. This is an excerpt from the leaked call.
This is my person. This is my problem. This is my issue. And I'm calling you because it's very serious with me personally. This man must be released. Major General Al-Kamish, is that his name? The PSO director, Major General Ghalib Al-Kamish. He knows all about this.
Mohammed Al-Rais.
Ambassador, and quite frankly, I'm calling this. This is my responsibility. I've talked to everybody in my government. I told them that I was going to make this call. I want to work with you, but I need this man released in the next 48 hours. This is my very personal appeal to you. After 50 days, this must stop.
It turned out later that the man in question was a dual American-Yemeni citizen by the name of Anwar al-Awlaki, a top leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP. An enigmatic figure in the so-called War on Terror, al-Awlaki could travel freely between Western countries like the United States and the United Kingdom, as well as Yemen, even after the 9/11 attacks. In the words of the leading Persian Gulf expert Ali al-Ahmad, the fact that this organization, Al-Qaeda, which has been attacked all over the world, continues to survive 20 years on and spread, it's not by accident. It's done by security and intelligence organizations in Washington, D.C. and in Qatar, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and by Ali Abdullah Saleh. Anwar al-Awlaki was trained in a U.S.-funded military camp in Afghanistan under the supervision of Osama bin Laden to fight off the Soviets in the country. He later recruited members in the United States to fight the Russians in Chechnya. As an imam in San Diego, he was in close contact with Nawaf al-Hazmi, Khalid al-Mihdar, and Hani Hanjour, three individuals who hijacked the planes that crashed into the Pentagon on September 9, 2001. In fact, al-Awlaki was reportedly in contact with other operatives of the 9/11 attacks. In 2002, al-Awlaki left the United States for the United Kingdom, where he stayed for a few days before returning to Yemen. Whereas he has enough freedom of movement in both the US and the UK, al-Awlaki was arrested again in Yemen for taking part in an al-Qaeda plot to kidnap a US military attaché and a Shia teenager. After a while, some US officials were disturbed at the imprisonment without charge of a United States citizen and signaled that they no longer insisted on Mr. Awlaki's incarceration, and he was released, according to the New York Times. After his release, al-Awlaki launched his own website, while his online rhetoric became more extremist and supportive of attacks against the United States. Abdul Hakim Mujahid Muhammad, the perpetrator of a drive-by shooting on a U.S. military recruiting office in Arkansas, as well as Nidan Hassan, who killed 13 and injured 30 at Fort Hood, were among the terrorists that attended al-Awlaki's lectures. It is almost impossible to make a list of those arrested for terrorist attacks or attempts who had contact with al-Awlaki or were inspired by him. According to the New York Times, al-Awlaki is considered to have helped inspire the Boston Marathon bombing, the 2015 attack in San Bernardino, California, and the shooting at the Orlando Pulse nightclub. After years of being protected by U.S. security and intelligence agencies, al-Awlaki was placed in 2010 on the U.S. kill list, and a year later, the CIA finally killed its own former asset with a drone strike.
Before I begin, I want to say a few words about some important news. Earlier this morning, Anwar al-Awlaki, a leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, was killed in Yemen. The death of al-Awlaki is a major blow to al-Qaeda's most active operational affiliate. Al-Awlaki was the leader of external operations for al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. In that role, he took the lead in planning and directing efforts to murder innocent Americans.
2 weeks after the killing of al-Awlaki, another drone strike ordered by Obama killed Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, Anwar's American-born 16-year-old son. 6 years later, President Trump ordered a raid that killed Nawar al-Awlaki, the 18-year-old daughter of Anwar. While the U.S. has repeatedly pounded al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen with bombs, the fact is that they are not entirely enemies. On the other hand, the Saudi coalition, which the U.S. is practically a part of, is at war with the Houthi Ansarullah movements and therefore shares a purpose in the country with al-Qaeda, expelling the Houthis from power. In 2018, the Associated Press reported that the coalition cut secret deals with al-Qaeda fighters, paying some to leave key cities and towns and letting others retreat with weapons, equipment, and wads of looted cash. Hundreds more were recruited to join the coalition itself. The point is, according to Major General Abdulghadir al-Shami of the Yemeni Security and Intelligence Service, the Americans used to train their individuals in Yemen and send them abroad to carry out operations for them, and then affix the accusation to Yemen as an excuse to come under the cover of fighting those individuals. Interestingly enough, since the U.S. supported the Saudi-led coalition against Yemen, al-Qaeda terrorists are parading around Yemen city streets in U.S.-made MRAP armored vehicles. In a report by the U.S. Department of State dating back to 1998, U.S. officials made it clear that they have special interests in Yemen. This place is suitable to host some spy aircrafts, including all fighters and air bombers, and with some additions and modifications in the proposed place, it will be suitable to accept many kinds of marine ships. These include aircraft carriers and also some submarines, which are working in the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea, and the Mediterranean Sea. The presence of terrorist groups can always provide the U.S. an excuse to have a military presence in the region. In fact, groups such as al-Qaeda and Daesh could not survive without support coming from the United States and other Western countries. But these fabricated enemies would be protected as long as they served these countries' interests and helped them reach their geopolitical goals.
IRIB English Radio.